Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. What will society look like when we rely solely on renewable energy? What will it take to realize this transformation? This morning, we continue last month's discussion with Richard Heinberg, who's co-author of Our Renewable Future, about the challenges facing us as we make this necessary but difficult transition from fossil fuels to 100% renewable sources of energy. Richard, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Good to be with you again, Barbara.
Well, I've been thinking a lot since our last conversation about sort of these two threads that your writing has and also the conversation that we had has. One of them is there's a whole lot of difficulties ahead of us if we're going to really survive, basically, because we have to transform our society to relying 100% on renewable energy. On the other hand, there seem to be some very positive aspects, some positive options that could become more possibilities if we do this transition. So I wanted to talk today about how this transformation might make things go from being bigger and bigger and bigger to maybe working on things becoming smaller and smaller and smaller. So let's start with cities. In the latest edition of State of the World 2016, Can a City Be Sustainable? You're the only person in that whole book who writes about the fact that it's not inevitable that cities will continue to get larger and larger and support most of the world's population. So let's talk about why you feel that the necessary transition to renewable energy may also put some constraints on the growth of cities.
Right. Well, it mostly has to do with transportation, which is and always has been essential to cities. If you look at the history of cities going all the way back, maybe not 10,000 years, but probably closer to 7,000 years, they've always been based on bringing resources and usually people as well from the periphery, from the countryside, into the urban core. So transportation has always been a big part of cities. And with ancient cities, you could really see that sort of parasitic effect of cities on the countryside, because typically once a city had been in place for a few centuries, the area immediately around it, you know, for a few miles or 100 miles or so around it, would typically be largely denuded of resources. But today's cities, of course, are global cities, really, because instead of sourcing our necessities, food and building materials and so on from within 100 miles or 500 miles of the city, we're sourcing these things globally with transport infrastructure that includes container ships, airplanes, trains, and trucks, of course. So as a result of that, the transition is going to be, I think, pretty steep, because when we talk about the renewable energy transition, one of the difficulties that we identified when we talked last time was transportation. Right now, when we talk about transitioning away from fossil fuels to renewables, we're mostly talking about the electricity sector, which is only about 20% of the energy that we use. But outside the electricity sector, we have industrial processes, transportation, agriculture, and so on. And these present some pretty substantial difficulties. Electric cars will maybe help move people around, but trucking is going to be much more difficult to transition. Container ships, even more difficult. And aviation is almost untransitionable, if we can coin a term. So that's going to have pretty substantial impacts for cities. So the opportunity for cities during the energy transition is going to be import substitution, finding ways of doing things, producing things, sourcing things locally, rather than depending upon global supply chains. And companies, people who can get in on the process of import substitution at the ground level, if you will, are going to benefit from this because it's an inexorable trend. Now, you know, localism is kind of a trendy thing right now, mostly for urban hipsters and so on. You know, we like to have our local stuff. But as the energy transition picks up steam, this isn't going to be so much trendy as, you know, necessary for the economic survival of cities. So that's one big trend.
Well, I was thinking as you were saying that traditionally with cities, like this expanse of 100 to 500 miles was kind of denuded around the cities. And I was thinking, well, we have this now, this trendy 100-mile diet, with the idea being that the area extending for 100 miles in a radius around a city would actually be fertile farmland where we could grow things. And I'm wondering about that vision. When I moved to Portland in 1971, Portland was ringed by farms, and you could go like 10 miles out of Portland and you'd be serviced by a whole lot of different farms. And a lot of the food that we ate in Portland in the early 70s was grown very locally. So how would we recreate that kind of relationship between the city and the countryside around it so that we could again get the resources we need close by and yet not denuded as was happening before? And on the other side, I was reading about this landfill that's actually not that far from where I live that was an active landfill in the 50s up until 1980, and all kinds of noxious, horrible, toxic things went in there, and they're just discovering that maybe it's contaminating the groundwater in a creek that goes by. So that's the other part of it, is that's like another lesson I think that we need to learn from the past about how we also don't, close to cities, despoil them with all of our toxic wastes.
Right. Yeah, well, let's start with food, because that was the initial premise of your question. There are already, as mentioned earlier, local food movements all over the place, and those can be strengthened through deliberate actions on the part of school systems, local governments, and so on. Through zoning regulations that make it easier for young farmers to gain access to land, by purchasing agreements with school systems for local produce, and so on. And again, these things are already being done. But those sorts of linkages can be strengthened also with just general local awareness. Buying local programs, farmers markets help enormously. And again, that's a big trend as well. Farmers markets have doubled in numbers in the last, I think, 15, 20 years here in the U.S. So in some ways, we're moving in the right direction. It's just that we need to speed up a heck of a lot if we're going to make these still relatively small trends the dominant trends. And then what we're talking about really is a transformation in agriculture, because if we just bring the giant agribusiness model into the local region, well, we're not really solving any problems, because agribusiness, as it exists right now, is a huge producer of pollution, a net destroyer of topsoil, and these are unsustainable trends. The opportunity is for carbon farming, where we actually use ecological principles for farming to build topsoil and thereby actually take carbon out of the atmosphere, put it back in the soil where it belongs. Soil, of course, then becomes much more productive as a result of that, and everyone wins. But, of course, there is a cost to the transition, because it's a more labor-intensive form of agriculture, and initially it's going to be more expensive to pursue. So it will require some support. Now, carbon farming could benefit from carbon credits, for example. If we had a price on carbon, then carbon farmers could benefit from every ton of carbon that they sequester back in the soil. But you know, we don't really have that right now.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Richard Heinberg, who's co-author of Our Renewable Future, and we're talking about some of the upsides and the downsides of going to a totally renewable future. I want to talk more today about the upside of really having a totally 100% renewable future, because there's a lot of downsides, which we talked about with Richard last month. Richard, I was listening. I was at a concert.
I wouldn't necessarily call them downsides. I'd call them costs.
Okay, right.
You know, and I think we have to be realistic that there are some substantial cost, not just in terms of the amount of money we'll have to spend for building solar panels and wind turbines, but the amount that it's going to cost to transform the ways that we use energy in buildings and in transportation and agriculture and so on.
I guess I'm thinking the downside is if we don't make this transition.
And that's a pretty big downside.
And I think that one of the things I wanted to do in the time that we have today is to kind of envision what the society that we could build that is, instead of being based on the larger the better, being based on returning to the community, returning to human scale, and returning to projects that are only as big as they need to be. I saw John Hyatt a couple of years ago here at the Blues Festival, and he was talking about, it was great to be in Portland. He travels to all these cities that used to be towns, and Portland was one of them. But he said, well, we're doing a good job here as opposed to some of the other towns that are now cities. I think Nashville was a big one he had in his mind.
Right.
And it made me think about, at that time, I would have agreed that Portland was doing a good job of transforming itself from a town to a city. Now a lot of people are beginning to wonder if we're not starting to get too big and too expensive and too detached from the values that I think have rooted Portland in the land that it's built on. So I wanted to spend the rest of the time talking about the kinds of projects that would evolve, like having local farming and returning to what you talked about, carbon-based farming, and talking about it in terms of the way that we generate power, as opposed to having big mega farm wind farms or mega solar panels, or of course natural gas and coal burning generators, to creating a sort of a democratically based energy system.
Right. Well, what you're talking about is what the energy geeks call distributed energy generation. Energy generation. And solar and wind power, especially solar PV, is inherently amenable to this kind of democratic energy system or distributed generation. It's also, I think, in the transitional phase, going to be really important to democratize energy, just because the kind of centralized utility and commercial utility systems that we have now are inherently unfriendly to renewable energy. They were built on the model of centralized production, and also on the model of using fuels, coal and natural gas, to produce electricity. And so trying to insert variable renewable energy electricity into the grid system makes everything sort of go haywire. And so you have commercial utility companies all across the country pushing back against renewables and trying to get renewable mandates taken away and feed-in tariffs taken away and so on. Because when the sun is shining, when the wind is blowing, these are really cheap sources of energy. But then when the sun isn't shining, the sun isn't blowing, the wind isn't blowing, then they need to produce electricity in other ways. And it just makes the whole system more expensive for them to operate. Well, who's going to pay for that? They don't want to pay for it, and they don't want to have to raise rates to customers. The only way I can see around this is something that is happening in more and more places, which is the formation of community choice aggregation. We have it here in California. I'm not sure of the situation in Oregon, but I live in Sonoma County, California, for example, and we, as a result of a state law passed a few years ago, it became possible for numbers of communities, 2, 3, 4, 5 communities, to band together and create their own public power agency. And we did that here in Sonoma County. It was also done in Marin County. And our local Sonoma Clean Power nonprofit has now enrolled just, I think, all of the cities within Sonoma County. And it produces power cheaper because it's not on a for-profit model, and it offers customers the option to purchase 100% renewable electricity, and it sources its electricity as much as possible from renewable sources, and is investing in producing local solar and wind production capacity. So if we're going to make the transition, I think it's going to have to be through that kind of, you know, publicly owned nonprofit model, as opposed to the conventional centralized for-profit utility systems.
We're talking this morning with Richard Heinberg, who's co-author of Our Renewable Future, and we're talking this morning about visualizing what that future would be and some of the ways that we could change the world, maybe for the better, by changing some patterns that we've gotten used to in the very unrenewable present that we're living in. So, Richard, welcome back to the program.
Yes, thank you.
So I guess what I was about to ask you before our last break was, I've heard arguments made when I would raise the suggestion in discussions I've been having over the last 10, 15 years about this, about why can't we focus more on locally produced and distributed energy? And I would be told, it's too urgent. Climate change is too much of a crisis. We have to do it on a big scale to serve everybody. So is there a way that a community-based energy production system could actually serve everybody, in the same way that big wind farms and big solar panel arrays would do?
Well, you know, it's where I'm seeing the real progress happen. It's not at the national and international level. Yeah, folks get together and make speeches every year at international climate meetings, and yes, President Obama has done some things, made some good decisions in recent months about climate and so on, but those things largely pale in comparison with what many localities are doing in, as we were saying earlier, developing their own publicly owned utility systems, investing in renewable energy, in weatherization programs that save energy, especially for lower-income people. These things are almost always happening on a local level, and that's where, you know, that's where the progress happens.
Well, and about 9 years ago, I visited the Googleplex and the Google headquarters, and I came back with a T-shirt that said, "My electricity comes from 93 million miles away. Where does yours come from?" And it was a T-shirt. It was actually a very cool T-shirt. It was the old pre-alphabet Google logo. And instead of on top of each of the Google letters, there was a solar array. And they were at that point putting solar panels on all of their parking structures and a lot of their rooftops. And it sounded like a really great, magnanimous program. Then I also learned what incredible tax abatement they were getting from the state of California for doing it. So right. I'm not sure it was done completely with the goodness of heart. But I wonder what kind of role businesses can play. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with Google's program and if you think it really has made a difference.
Well, it certainly makes a difference for Google. They're purchasing less energy from the grid and producing more renewable energy on their own. And I think as a business decision, it's worked out well for them, and it helps the state of California achieve its renewable energy targets. So, generally speaking, yeah, it's good for businesses. And again, my experience is here locally in Northern California, wine country, and we have a about 200 wineries here in Sonoma County, and a good many of them, I'm not sure the exact proportion, but very many of them are decked out with solar panels and producing their own energy. It makes financial sense especially as long as there are state programs for rebates or renewable energy portfolios or time of use metering. And again, you know, it helps achieve these the targets.
Now, do you see that there is there a direction that's happening now where there are this possibility of these programs really becoming instituted? I'm just wondering, like, where we really go from here to make our future 100% renewable in a timely fashion, and how this can be done primarily through local efforts.
Right. Well, it's ultimately, it's got to get beyond just putting up solar panels and wind turbines. As we talked about last time, it's got to get into the question of how we use energy. And so households have a big part in this in terms of how they choose their transport options. If you have a car, and need a car, then an electric car option or at least a hybrid makes sense. But then if you have the possibility, as most folks who live in Portland do, of being car-free and getting around by bicycle and public transportation, that's a far better option from an energy standpoint, climate standpoint. Then home heating. Most of us have natural gas space heaters here on the West Coast. Well, how about switching that out for an air source heat pump? There are lots of those available now. That means you can use electricity to produce heat rather than burning natural gas, but you're producing heat in a much, much more efficient way than used to be the case with the old electric baseboard heaters. Cooking, a lot of the energy transition just has to do with electrifying things that currently we're using fuels for. And then beyond that, it's the question of, as we were talking about earlier, import substitution. If I need a service or a product, how can I source that more locally as opposed to from global supply chains? Everything we do along those lines helps with the process of the energy transition. And the more we're public about that, the more people who understand the implications of shopping in the global marketplace versus shopping in the local marketplace, the faster this transition can occur.
Well, one of the problems is that we're so used to things being cheap because of the global marketplace. And
right.
I know that every time I make a decision to buy something local, it's coming... Well, some of it's actually convenience. I actually much prefer to buy locally. But in some cases, I'm paying quite a bit of a premium. It might be on a $150 item. I could save $30, $40 getting it online. So it seems like there's a lot of mindset and a willingness to pay more money. And then there's some people who are not in the position to be able to pay that extra 15-20%. So
right.
How do we incorporate those issues in trying to get people to really rebuild a local economy?
Well, good question. I think part of it is a mindset change. Most of us are still, to one degree or another, stuck in the consumer mindset that evolved during the 20th century, and there were reasons behind it. You know, creation of jobs and returns on investment and increasing GDP to produce more tax revenues for governments and so on. But we're beyond that now. You know, the era of economic growth, the era of globalization, those are coming to an end. So, you know, we, the general population, need to be out ahead of the kind of, what would you say, the what the government is telling us. I mean, politicians are still saying, effectively, we can make America great again. And by that, they mean we can all live like we did in the 1960s and 70s and have economic growth and consumerism and so on. But the reality is very different. And I think younger people, millennials, kind of get that. They understand that life isn't about how much stuff you own. It's about the quality of life and the experiences you have. So if we make that change in our mindset, then if we don't need to consume as much, and in fact, when we do buy durable goods, we're much more interested in quality rather than in just getting the cheapest thing we can at Walmart. So I think that's a big part of it.
Well, there's also so much pressure. I mean, I'm thinking like the new iPhone 7 is just being released. And Right. Of course, there's already talk about what the iPhone 8 will be. And there's a drive in the way that things are advertised and marketed that makes you feel like you're always one step behind the curve. And I find it very frustrating to live in a world where I can't be happy with what I have because I'm going to be obsolete in a while. And I need the next operating system so that I can communicate with the rest of the world. So I guess I'm wondering is how do we put pressure on businesses so they stop this? I mean, I would just like to buy something and think this is a great thing and maybe it'll last me for 20 years.
Yeah, I think we need a deep cultural cynicism about planned obsolescence. And in effect, I think if we're successful in that, if we can make that a cultural meme, then effectively we can shame manufacturers into doing the right thing and making more durable goods rather than stuff that's going to become obsolete and break down before it has to. But, you know, that's also going to have to be supported by shifts in the economy itself. You know, as long as companies are beholden to shareholders, they're publicly traded companies, then they're more or less forced into this consumerist planned obsolescence mindset. But as we see more B corporations, nonprofit organizations engaging in design and manufacturing of goods and so on, there are other incentives that can come to the fore rather than, you know, pure profit motive.
Well, Richard, it's always good talking with you, and I'm looking forward to your next book. We can talk again. Do you have any plans about what you're going to be writing about next?
I'm not working on anything right now. I'm actually still very much in the process of spreading the news about our renewable future.
I know that feeling. I'm doing the same thing with the film we just put out. So people sometimes hate when somebody says, "What's your next project?" Well, I'm really immersed in my current one. Well, anyway, we'll probably talk again soon. Thanks a whole bunch for joining us.
I hope so. Good talking with you, Barbara.
We've been talking with Richard Heinberg, who's co-author of Our Renewable Future. You've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, KBOO.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk with Tom Prue, director of World Watch Institute's State of the World series, Anthologies, about creating democracy in sustainable communities from the bottom up. My engineer is Natasha Delapine. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some very quick music by Joni Mitchell. Thanks for listening.
The minus is loveless. He talks to the land, and the leaves fall, and the pond overrises. She don't know the system, plus she don't understand. She's got all her own fuses and splices. She's not gonna fix it up.